Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, at least over here on the East Coast. For those of you on the West Coast, it would be good afternoon. And that is where my guest tonight is. He is on the West Coast. And his name is Lee J. McCloskey. Hopefully I pronounced it right. And I'm going to be dialing his number. And we are going to be talking to him about his film, TV work, and his art. Lee J. McCloskey. Hopefully it will be dialing. And hopefully everything will go okay. Stay with us.
Hello.
Hello, Lee. This is Mac.
Hey, Mac. How are you? Good to have you connect.
Yeah, thank you. So I take it you can hear me okay.
I can hear you great. How do I sound?
You sound great as well. I just always make sure because it's the surefire way of making sure that we're on the air, as if we can both hear each other.
Yeah.
So,
oh, great. Okay. Well, good.
So how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing really well. Now, are you in, where do you live? Where's home?
I live in Ohio.
Oh, in Ohio, okay, because I saw your number come up as the Bronx, and I went, and it's so funny on Facebook and everything, we never know where anybody lives. You know, post pictures and go, that's lovely, you know, where are you? So, great. Now,
yeah.
You've been out to the house, right, though? You've come here, though. We've met. Have we?
We haven't.
Oh, okay, well, that's good to know, because, I didn't know if you had come, because we used to, and are looking forward to doing it again. But, you know, we've always hosted the gatherings here. So I thought maybe we had met before. But, good. Well, I'm looking forward to talking. So whenever you want to dive in, let's dive in.
Okay. Well, I know that your father was an artist. So now, is that where you got part of your inkling to become an artist? And did you start drawing as a young child?
The short answer is yes. I was really very fortunate because I have had a father who was an artist, but the gift he gave me was he didn't teach me how to paint. He gave me the gift of really teaching observation, of looking, and great guidance when he would say, don't tell me about what you're looking at, tell me about how you feel about what you're looking at. So there was always this deep, and this has become abiding in me, of course, which is this deeper sense that you would paint to ask questions. And when I was studying acting, because I always thought of myself as an actor, my dad was, when you're the son of a really great painter, you think, well, I'll choose a different profession. But I'd always loved acting, and I'd started way back in kindergarten just following that path. But one of the great keys my dad gave me, and it was sort of a blending of art and acting, was that because he hadn't told me, again, how to paint, I remember I called him from New York. I was at Juilliard. And I said, Dad, I'm really getting to a point with art where I really think I should maybe start studying. And he said, don't, because he felt he was overtrained, that he was fighting, in a way, his training. And he had seen my imagination. And he said, what I really would suggest is go to the museums. And, of course, in New York, there are great museums. And he said, if you're attracted to a painter, start looking at the painter, roll up a tube, the program, and look through it like a magnifying glass. Don't look at the painting, look at how the painting was painted. And he said, let them be your guide, let them be your mentor, not with words, but really by looking deeply. And I used that when I was working on my tarot. I started looking at engravings, really looking at technique. But the melding for me was when I was in New York as a student. I was playing a part in a play at Juilliard, and it was a very violent character, and we wanted to kill his father, and I could not find that vehemence of violence. I was acting, and I knew it. And my dad had always given me the advice. He said, when you can't talk about something, paint it. And that was the gift. It wasn't to be a painter. It was to use the medium of paint as a way of asking questions, to use it as a tool of inquiry, really much more like Leonardo or Einstein, that sense of use it as a thought experiment. And that's what I did. I started, and I had seen a calligrapher, this Japanese calligrapher, talking about energy, about chi, about prana, and this relationship to breath and emotion, and using the calligraphy, the way of catching the breath, that it wasn't about illustrating anything. It was about the aliveness of the motion of the gesture. And I thought, well, that's very much like acting. You know, how do you connect with the emotional truth of a character. And so that became really my, and that became, so my artist side was never to be an artist in an outward sense. It was always this way I was able to finally ask questions. And so even my art developed from that approach, not to being a painter, but what my dad really gave me, which is use it as a tool to ask questions that can't be asked in another way.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just a wonderful thing to have a parent that not only instills something in you, but they give you encouragement. And because a lot of people don't have that with their parents.
They really don't at all. And that was the richness that I realized. See, my mom was a teacher. She went back and got her teaching credential when I was in third grade. And, you know, and so there's like, She was the kindest person I know, but she was also, I called her the judge. She was the one that was able to balance and find, really almost you'd say, taking on a more masculine role of you know, traditionally. But it was a very great balance between having a very creative father who was also a brilliant in physics and just a genius, and then my mom who was just. You know, an amazing, because she taught me, as I say, why she taught me to be a gentleman. She taught me to be chivalrous, you know, and it wasn't because she said women are weak. She said, you treat people with respect. That's a good idea. You know, so between the two of them, I feel that it was the establishment of a type of value system that has lasted and really been a basis of what I've tried to share, you know, as I've matured. You know, how do you help people feel confident in their creativity? You know, that's really my goal, is to say, you know, don't worry about writing a poem for others. Write it for the creative spirit. Your first relationship is intimate. You know, if you're looking for love, you're not looking for a group.
Right.
Know?
And I
think that that's why, you know, because people say, what do I have now? And I say, well, let's reclaim the tools we've always had. You know, that sense of not painting to be a painter, but I need to put my hands in there. I need to, you know, when I do my painting classes, I always start people with finger painting. And I get them on the floor. I get them really trying, almost like combining acting, to connect breath, the body, and, you know, touch, because we are quite literally out of touch, but we're also out of trust, you know. And so, you know, part of my work is also to say, you know, one of the questions you have to ask is, where do I feel safe? That's why when people came to my house for a tour of the hieroglyph or different gatherings we'd have here, I said, remember that this energy of home is where we feel safe. We look out for each other. And we feel grateful because we've been invited into intimate space. And it started me realizing that I really think we've reached this point where you know, the last question is intimacy. How do we live with these things? All of my work in the mythic is, in a sense, saying, yeah, it's all fine and well, but how do we live this? And now with the world getting so strange, it's saying, you use it with your imagination. You don't use it, you know, with vengeance. You use it to augment your realization that you're much more capable than what you think. And you are the technology. It's not something you need. It's something you are. And it awakens because
right.
you ask questions, you know?
Mhm.
Yeah.
Well, since you already mentioned it, we'll go ahead and talk about that, the hieroglyph of the human soul. Now, for the listeners that don't know, this is an art installation that's painted on the walls of Lee's personal library, and he does tours and everything. So tell us about that.
Well, we just honored 9/11 19 years ago. And the hieroglyph of the human soul is what it calls itself. It announced itself really on the day of when the towers came down in New York. And I never expected this story to emerge. And simply put, because it's hard, we don't live in a mythic time where these make a lot of sense, and I'm so deeply steeped in it, so I have to realize. A hieroglyph essentially is a picture, meaning that it's saying, almost like consciousness or human form saying, here, enough with the questions and debate and the arguments, let me draw you a picture. Because we can't contain a picture. In a way, it's where, like music, we're allowed to say, you're going to see this differently than Lee does. You're going to hear it differently, but it is just as valid in the same way as if I read a poem or you read a poem. It's not that one is right or wrong. It's they live uniquely. And so 9/11, and there's this through line with my work earlier on the Tarot and my work for Tarot Revision, which we'll talk about a little later, but that had a 9/11 key, is that one of the last numbered drawings, which is the 21st key, the world archetype, is dated. I did not realize this until I reworked it, but it's dated 9/11/1986. So it's 15 years to the day of the falling of the Twin Towers. And it has Twin Towers in the drawing, or Twin Pillars. And why I find this significant is that I think it's from my theater background, just the way I was raised, too, is I don't want to tell a story at your expense. I think that's bad theater. I don't want you to be hurt so I can achieve. And so the question at the end of the day is, well, how do we tell a story that includes all of us? And what I love, because this was a completely unexpected and has become, because I've painted for the last 19 years, an ongoing painted revelation, that began with a language, essentially, a type of calling itself the Watcher language. And if I was to liken it to something, if you're a musician, it's like leaning into a riff. If you improvise, it's that willingness to just go with something. And what flowed through me, and I think it was because 9/11, for all of us that lived through those days, was a time of such trauma, such despair, such... I even liken it when I do the tours. I said that I really feel that if I was filming it, I'd show Michelangelo falling from the ceiling, meaning the vaulted sense of it's important what we think about God and what we're against and for, you know, since the vaulted ego that got us so far, like the erections, the twin erections of 9/11, which become in our mythic narrative Babel, meaning the Babel of money and God, the twin erections of...
Right.
What we think of as the age of Pisces, meaning that, well, what was that? And people say it was patriarchy, but it was literally the binary of authority, meaning that it was, I have more money than you do, you must be obedient, and the man of God saying, I have God and you don't, you must be obedient. And these two brothers rise, and the narrative of the collapse is that 9/11 then is the falling of the age, meaning we will no longer be able to get an erection based upon I have more than you do. It will get out of hand. And what's extraordinary is that when I saw the mythic signature of things and realized that what triggered the hieroglyph of the human soul is the relationship to the collective collapse. And I was on my knees on the linoleum floor of the studio library. And I realized as a father and as a husband, I said, I have to tell my wife and my daughters, I have to tell them it's their love that's healed me. All the books I've collected, all the things and questions I've asked, those have deepened my curiosity and my sense of the wonder of being human. But what gave me roots, what gave me meaning was their love. And almost like setting out not to do something grand, and it has become something grand, nor something, I didn't have an agenda. And about a year into it, a friend of mine, Don Estes, said, Lee, have you looked at this with 3D glasses? And I kind of poo-pooed it, and then I put them on. And lo and behold, it turns out to be a fixed multidimensional state, meaning that the creation itself says, if you look at me one way, look at me again. And so I put on the glasses, and suddenly I'm standing in this multidimensional reality that, like having a child, there's no way I could conceive of, oh, yeah, I did this. I figured this out. But what I did realize is that it doesn't come from nowhere. I've had a Tuesday night discussion group in my home going back to when I was doing the show Dallas, because when I was doing Dallas, there was great accolades. Oh, this is so successful. But I started to realize that I didn't want to be angry at what Hollywood wasn't. I said a bit like a patron, you know, let me honor what is given, which was I was able to move to Malibu, which I'd grown up a few miles away from where I've moved. You know, I was able to actually move out here with my wife and to create. And I said, well, I'm going to open my home. I'm going to open it to discussion groups. And so I have had for 39 years, I've had over 3,900 discussion groups that I had for 25 years. I had a ULT theosophy discussion group here. And to balance that, then had Western inner tradition, Jung, the Red Book. And what that helped do was to cultivate community. But going back to the hieroglyph, why I feel that it emerged here was that because everyone feels like I have no power. I don't, you know, I love them and it doesn't matter. The world's so full of hate. I care so much and it's slapped out of my hand. People laugh at, you know, and I said, you know, what this has taught me is that we're the custodians in like our home. It's not something we're trying to impress the neighbors with. It's, well, how do I do this? How do we do this? It's a much more intimate question. And so the people who found their way here over the years, these thousands of discussion groups and then thousands on top, even more of public gatherings, you know, I realized that that was the energy that was being planted here. And we live on sacred Chumash land, which were the indigenous you know, first Americans that, you know, lived on this land, had no word for war, and all, you know, and didn't leave because they wanted to. And so the question becomes, well, as a custodian, you know, what do you do with that? And what I've learned is you honor, like a librarian, you bear witness and you say, you know, the sorrows of the ages cannot be quelled by my tears, and it's not looking for my puny sympathy. So how do I honor it? And what I love is the people who showed up, and if you lived out here, you would have showed up. It's people that showed up from all different backgrounds saying, you know what, I have to talk about these things. I'm going to go mad if I can't talk about meaning and about story and myth and, you know, why are we here and all of the questions that people don't have time for. But what's happened here is that the garden that began on 9/11, this seed, has now grown, and I've painted my floor, my walls, my ceiling, my furniture. And what's remarkable is it, like the tarot, it's an instrument, it's a structure. It's as if, like the library itself, we had to offload all of these things to finally not be trying to get somewhere else, but to finally, almost like Dorothy, go, oh my God, I don't care if it's black and white, I just want to be with the people I love.
That's beautiful. I would love to have been part of one of those little get-togethers and talks and get a view of that. And you never know, maybe in the future I will get to do that.
We've been Zooming more because of the pandemic. So, you know, that's sort of the baby steps forward because I laugh, but, you know, when the towers came down, I became a cave painter. I mean, I'm basically doing the first technology paint and the storytelling, you know, so there's no, but the other technologies that are coming in and really have, they do. I think they're coming in a way to help us, in a way, irrigate shared curiosity. And so, you know, we'll see what happens. But I really, and I'm looking forward to when I can have people in the circle, in the round table, because that's always been marvelous to have, you know, just visitors. We've always had it open, never said, who are you, what do you do? Just said, you're interested? Come on in.
Aw. That's a wonderful philosophy to have.
Well, you know, I was one of those guys, I grew up, you know, we didn't lock our door, and I've always had an innate trust of people, but living in New York gave me an innate trust of people with a good sense of practical caution.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, trust, but don't be a damn fool. Yeah.
Yeah, there's being trusting and then there's being dumb.
That's the way my dad always put it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Fool me once type of thing.
Yeah. Well, since you had mentioned it before, we might as well talk. Actually, you might as well talk about it now. Now, you have published 6 books, but you know that would take quite a bit of time to talk about all 6 books. So I just want to have you talk about that first one. I think it was in 2003 that what you mentioned earlier, Tarot Revision, your books and cards.
So
talk about that, and then also about what it's like writing and then having books published in general, like, you know, generally speaking.
Oh, yeah, that's right, the agony. thanks. It's a true labor of love. One of the things that I feel in my life when I have to look at this clues as to why I'm able to do what I'm able to do, because a lot of times people get very swept away by different energies because they over-identify with them. They start thinking they're it. And, you know, but as an actor, you realize it's like playing a king. If you start thinking you are the king, you better get to the hospital. The key is not to believe in these things, but to allow them, as in theater, to be embodied. And I think that one of the keys, again, that is what the tarot archetypes are called, is that, and I have to say, because I was very honored by the review, but the book was reviewed as possibly the most significant contribution to the tradition in over 100 years. And why I start with that is because I do feel a bit like Chippendale, or making a piece of furniture. I did not just scrimp. I didn't just rush something, because I didn't have a conceit that I would ever write a book about the tarot, nor even create a tarot. I wasn't, to begin with, all that interested in it. It wasn't like I didn't wake up and go, one day I'm going to, you know, I would have, before, you know, a couple of years before doing it, I would have thought, I would have looked at you with crossed eyes thinking, no, not doing a tarot, thank you, Mac, you know. And then, but there's an old saying about Hermes from the Hermetic tradition that you're always tricked onto your path. And the tarot comes out of the Hermetic tradition, which is really, you'd say, a shorthand for the wisdom tradition. And that I had found a meditation, actually, through another actor, Michael Chifo, because I was looking for something that allowed me to really explore my mind. I have lucid dreams out of body experiences. I have things that I did not need drugs. People said, did you take drugs? I went, I needed to find my life. I needed to find an anchor. I did not need to get further out. But the tarot came about when Edwin Steinbrecher, who was writing actually the 6th revised edition of his very excellent book called The Inner Guide Meditation, very helpful tool. And he asked if he could use some of my drawings, and I said, well, I know something about that tradition. I've always found the images a bit wanting, and, you know, it's all, you know, how hard could that be? And you know, I was young and stupid, what can I say? So that arrogance paid off, because for the next 17 years, I really bled those things into existence, it felt like, because in a way, I started to see sort of myself in the mythic storyline, meaning that a bit like the fool, I bumble in and I think, oh, there's nothing here, only to find out not only is it not nothing, it's an extraordinary lens that once you enter into it begins to allow you to penetrate the surface of the outer world of things and really see the deeper codes, the deeper strategies, and the deeper structure of the story of why am I wired the way I am? Because one of my jokes was, but it's true, you know, people say, Lee, be yourself. And I always thought, well, which one? You know, do you want me when I'm happy or do you want me when I'm angry? They don't even seem related. And I started to think about, well, how do we access? Because I wondered as an actor, I mean, because I've played some very, very dark characters, and I always wondered why when I allow these qualities to move through me, are a bit like a dancer. I have no fear of them. I don't take them personally, but I can feel their truth in a sense. Like if I'm playing evil, it's not playing at Yeah, it's flowing. And I started to think about Indigenous, you know, with masks and all these things, that it was that we are, these energies flow through us, and that was the key to the archetypes. And so when I started work on it, and I didn't expect to do everything. I was writing. I started with the death archetype for his magazine. Actually, I did the drawing, and then I wrote my first article. And then he said, "Well, can you do?" And so I started at death, which is interesting. You know, a seed does not sprout lest it die. And I think that for me was I died to an old way of seeing. Also, because to do it, it's a bit like singing Wagner. I mean, you can't just wing it. You know, you're
right,
plunged into a type of soul dedication, and I have to tell you, if you're working on the tarot, you also have to get used to people rolling their eyes and wondering, well, what's the point? And not really even being mean from their point of view, but thinking you're kind of foolish. I mean, it's just, you know, some silly occult or, you know, devil's this or that. But it was, and that's really just the ignorance usually coming from Hollywood films. But what I found much more interesting, because I took much more of the realization of Carl Jung and of Joseph Campbell and myth, and that's why my book is not about divination. It is about, well, how do these characters, like if we think of the 22 arcana or the 22 tarot archetypes, they're the empress, the emperor, the hierophant, the lovers. But essentially what we're seeing, if we were casting a play, we're casting all these parts, and all of these parts are in the world. There's always a fool. There's always an emperor. There's always a devil. There's always these characters being played out. And I wanted to know, well, how do we actually begin to recognize not what's wrong with others? Like in theater, you can't judge a character. If you're playing a killer, you can't look at him and go, oh, what an awful guy. You have to find out and live within the character. Well, why do I feel justified? You know, what's my mathematics here? You know, what's my emotional truth? And because I could approach it as an actor approaches the arcana, the emotional truth led me into realms that had not, I feel like an archaeologist that was able to go really to a whole layer that had not been able to be brought forth because the art wasn't there, because what led was not my having figured anything out any more than you can figure out Hamlet. What you do is the due diligence. You do rehearsal, you do memorization, you do, and you try and try and try. And then finally, the character gels. You can feel it. You know it. You are it. And he can come and go, but you know the truth. It's almost like the needle sets. Ah, there he is. And I step forward on the stage. This was the same thing with the archetypes, was this realization that most of the work done on the tarot is a metaphysician or an occultist with an artist. And so it's been looking at a type of occult system or belief system. And I realized that it wasn't any of that, that it was a tool. It was like a piano. It was a resource for the creative imagination that says once you can put yourself at the center of the wheel and stand as that hub, and then around you, you can see the 22 spokes, the 22 characters. And if they all rose up around you and said, I am the north, east, south, and west of you, meaning you are all of this. And like what I love when people are here, they stand up in a library. I say, what does the library tell you? It says, you are unique, because we look in the mirror here, and it says, yes, you're Lee or you're Mac. But when we turn around, we actually see a library. And the greater question is, well, what are the books? And it says, well, the books are the story of the human, the willingness to be human. The question, what does it mean to be human? And when you look in the mirror, you realize that's what you are. You're a book in this library. Your DNA holds all of these stories. So the question does become, we are the technology. We are the instrument. And one of the things I've been trying to, because I never allowed politics into my discussion groups, and there's so much political fury, is to move into the archetypal theater, to see the symbolical theater, because we start to recognize that that we are not. It's sort of like blaming the play if you're in Richard III and you're angry at Richard III. well, Richard III is doing his job, because it's not about Richard III. It's about the transformation of those that can be transformed. They must respond differently. Therefore, they must find their heroic nature, because he cannot. And this is what I learned by being a villain. I said, I'm the guy who can't change. I'm the one that hates you because you can. I can't love, and you can. So I distrust you, because you can do it. You know, in other words, you start to realize, oh, I get it. This is based not on, you know, I even tell people, I played Damian Smith on General Hospital, and I modeled the character after Donald Trump 25 years ago. And then ironically, the Tarot Arcana, they're all called Trumps. That's what they call them. So you have the Tower Trump, or the 16th key, the Trump Tower. And it is Mars. Mars sets things on fire. Do you see, Mars is that which inflames. And that's why if we understand these things archetypally, and that's why when the Woolsey Melville Park fire came to our door and we stayed, but I was hit by a fire tornado. I was quite literally punched in the chest in the back of the house. It came 2 years to the day of the election, and the story was that the fire, the rage of neighbor against neighbor, that communities were being lost. Everything was going up in flames. We were forgetting about what we loved and giving ourselves to fury. And this is an important point the Tarot Revision says. It says, if you can understand that, like the library, you must take this fury because you're actually at home and you don't want to burn your children, you have to learn how to turn that rage into incubation, you know, not just a wildfire, because that'll destroy not only you, but everyone. Because how do you turn it down? How do you turn it down? How do you turn the story into not what I fear, but what I love? And that is why, you know, a lot of my journey now is to try and call out and say, you know, you're the storyteller. You're the one that decides what you value most. And when you see, as we did with the fire here, and we had 240 neighbors, and now we have lost 180 of them. You know, you realize everyone's devastated. Everyone's on their knees. You know, nobody thought they'd lose everything. And now in California, with all of the fires in Oregon and Washington, Colorado, and about, I mean, it's just, if we don't begin to see not who to blame, but that we must really understand that we are the tool to navigating this storm, and that's what the tarot gives us. Actually, that's why I say that if you put it around you and you think of it like a gyroscope, like a wheel spinning, it's not to blame the outer world, but to navigate it by what truly matters to you. And that's why even going back to the sense of art or painting is to bring it back, not to be writing a song because you think you're going to be the Beatles, or painting a painting because you'll make $1 million like Picasso, or write the great novel. You know, I think we strive to do that which, you know, since makes us say, I can't do that. And so I just say now, like when, especially being forced at home, it's like, well, just grow a little garden, grow something in love. Tell the universe, I love you, you know, in spite of all of it. And maybe I have to whisper because I might be thought of as foolish, but at least between you and me, let me know you know, I think the journey was worth it. You know, and I think that that's why it's not something big. It's like it's shifting of how we use our energy. You know, I say it's a mental martial art moment. And that's what the archetypes and the tarot helps us with. Yeah,
that makes
a lot of sense. Yeah, because once you understand, it's like if what got you here was karate, meaning I'll kick your ass, but where we go from here is aikido or jujitsu, meaning I got too much to do, I'll let you kick your own ass, meaning that we stop engaging in fierce arguments that, in a way, draw us into a vortex of the unresolvable. And it's almost like pulling back. And that was the one thing about when the fires were raging around us and burning everything in a great, really a great circle at one point. It was pulling back. I realized that like a siege of dragons, you don't know how to fight a dragon. You never learn how because there's not a way to do it. But what it teaches you is to not keep your eye on the greater fire. It'll freak you out. But to keep your eyes on your what you can see, what you can actually be a guardian of. And that's what I did. I was fastidious, and we were able to save our block because Garla and I were the only two, my wife and I, who who's my hero, she said, when the police said, everyone out. She said, if my husband's not leaving, I'm not leaving, and he's not leaving, so we're not leaving. And he said, all right, I'm out of here. And then the fire hit, but we were alone, and you know, absolutely alone. And it was, and the great tragedy is so often they get everyone out, and everyone flees. And I grew up out here. I'm an old Malibu boy, and I was taught you don't leave, because, and it's true, a lot of times what happens is it's embers, and we saw so much of that, where things just caught on fire later because no one was there to keep an eye on things, you know.
Right.
But it was eye-opening. It's eye-opening, because I think it's like we got to start realizing we've got to be prepared. There's no one really – don't think someone's there. Let's put it that way. Or if
right.
they show up, they might be a day late and a dollar short, which happened to Malibu.
Yeah.
It's really tragic, but another story, you know. Yeah. Yeah, it's so something's changing us, and that's one of the things I think is helpful. Why, you know, because I've wondered about like this movement through an acting career, and then a family life, and then a community life, and you know what it's really led me more and more to realize, and I rather feel it's like what you're doing with your podcast. You know, it's not that we reach vast audiences, but it's that realization. Even physicists are starting to understand. They're saying that they're starting to see that the what we think of as the cosmos is a great neurology, and
mm-hmm.
that's one of the keys to why, I always say now play the quantum. It's that there's no reality, only probability. So what is the version, if everything is infinitely possible, what's the version you want to draw forth? And I even say about the hieroglyphs that quite literally when we step into this art, into this creation, it is the creation that has been drawn forth. And the drawing forth has been an act of devotion and love, because the qualities are as the gardener, which is not to control the outcome of the seed, but let the seed be living, not dead. You know, this is why in my arcana, I don't have a magician. I don't have someone that tricks you. I have a magus. I have an initiator into the mysteries, saying if you want to enter the mystery of yourself, you must not ask questions of fear and hate. This will keep you outside the wheel. Yours is to plant a seed of a greater love, a deeper knowing, and a willingness to step into the mystery, you know, to be mentored by it. And isn't this what life is anyway? I mean, who knows what tomorrow's going to bring?
Right.
You know, we always think, no, we don't. And so we're afraid, oh, we're going to step into the mystery. It says you're doing it all the time. So at least do it with questions that will cultivate a sense of a deeper wonder or possibility, because in this you realize you're freeing not simply yourself, but the story you're telling in allowing you to breathe more allows others to breathe more. Do you know that it's something that I rather feel that this process going on now is what you'd almost say is the implementation of a deeper etiquette of energy, a type of insistence that anything is possible, but you have a role in the relationship. You cannot just take and expect, like a child, that will be rewarded. You will realize that only in relationship, only in developing responsibility, can the things you really need occur. And, you know,
right.
and I really think that's why. You know, a lot of people are exhausted now. And I almost feel like when you're exhausted, you finally let go of the life raft and discover, oh, I didn't know I knew how to swim.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, how about we delve into your film and TV work? Since
sure.
we still got like 50 minutes yet since I extended
the show. Oh, yeah, we can go
show.
Back and forth. And, and also if something sparks your interest, you know, just jump in and interject, because it's hard. I'm talking to a phone, so it's like, you know, I feel like if I'm rambling.
Oh, I know.
No, you know, but I do. I feel like I want to, I'm now at this place. I turned 65. I'm born on the summer solstice, so I turned 65 this year. And it's sort of that, you know, it's not just the time you retire. It's also the time you realize oh, I get it. It's not about getting somewhere. It really is about putting, well, why? You know, what was the point? Why the acting career? Why public success? What was the story of the need to develop then this other side that cultivated the art and cultivated the conversation and philosophy, this honoring of philosophia, of wisdom, of curiosity?
Right.
And that's one of the keys for me because when I was at Juilliard and I came out to the West Coast, I returned, and that was in 1975, and I did a Streets of San Francisco and a show called Phyllis with Doris Leachman, which was live. And so I was getting my feet wet, and then early, you know, fairly, in a, I was doing a pilot for a show called Executive Suite, and Brenda Sykes had a black girlfriend and a, you know, a terrorist, an American terrorist sister and a corporate father. So it was all quite the pre, you know, it's preceded Dallas actually by a year or two. And then I did some films. One was Dawn, Portrait of a Teenage Runaway, and Alexander, The Other Side of Dawn, which looked at street hustling, got into the relationship of this hustler with a football player and with this girl, Eve Plum, played named Dawn, and this ideals. But it was interesting. That was also a movie where I was asked by the director if he could incorporate some of my art because he understood that I was a painter. So I designed the mural for that, which was interesting.
Cool.
And so there's been always this strange, even on Executive Suite, I became a member of ASCAP because one of the songs I had written they used on the show. So there were these little hints at these other things other than acting. And I and my wife is an assistant director. She Carla McCloskey, and she had done Jurassic Park and Hook and Point Break, and she actually ended up working on Gilmore Girls, directing Gilmore Girls. She's going to be with the Gilmore Girl Fan Fest coming up October 17th, and a lot of people love that show, and she loved it too. So, so she was always working. We were both working, and I really, it was interesting because I found that acting to a great degree, one has to figure out how to keep your energy up. You know, how to not sort of keep, because you're always trying to get the next job, you're wondering about this. And so I almost look at my career now in different periods, like the 70s. I did film Inferno with Dario Argento. I played these interesting characters. It was as if the 70s, there was more of a type of inquiry into, like, all right, I've got this rich white kid and this black, you know, girl, and we're going to get together, and she and I then, are, you know, and this was 75. So it was really trying to deal with that. And then I played paraplegic, but I was very manipulative. I was not a good guy. I played this very, it was a very interesting role. So it was like they were stretching, they were questioning boundaries. And then when I played Alexander, it was looking into the gay lifestyle and into hustlers and street hustlers, you know, really sort of themes that they wouldn't deal with until it went into Netflix and all these other, you know, sort of where they're looking at all sorts of darkness. But that was a little cult film called Bermuda Depths. These films that in the 70s, in a way, landed on people. And you know what happens is I realize a certain people, you see a certain film at a certain point in your life, and it has almost some branding effect on you. It's like a song. You remember it, and it brings back a lot of connections. And so Bermuda Depths has that for a lot of different people, and so it's interesting to see that. And then the 80s was when I'd entered into doing Dallas, which was an education because it was incredibly. I came on when it was what they called "Who Shot JR," which for the people who were alive then was, it was on everyone's mind and everyone talked about it.
Yeah, that was
so
a big
there was
deal.
All, yeah, it was a big deal. So it was interesting to experience that level of fame, of that type of world recognition, And I guess it's because I never over-identified with it, nor really sort of, and it's also my Gemini and tendency to sort of observe myself at times rather than, oh, that's real. I think, no, it's more like it's part of the collective theater and people seeing you a certain way. But that was a great education. I went on and did a lot of guest episodics, a lot of TV movies, and then did a lot of the General Hospital. I played Damian Smith, and I was on Young and the Restless, and I was on Santa Barbara playing Zach Kelson, and one of my dear friends, A. Martinez, actually, who we met, and he's a genius actor, but also a tremendously noble soul. He came and helped when the fires were here. He came and helped me, and it was just, he came through roadblocks. Uh-huh. He made it here. It was like a miraculous thing, but so a true brother. And then I did, I actually worked with Max Factor for a cologne called California for Men, which was Jacqueline Smith was California for Women, and Jane Seymour did Jardin the Max Factor. That was educational. It was like, I was in a way, everything in my career educated me to look at not what I thought was important, but to be in these different worlds essentially, and to see what was held to be of value. Do you know, in other words, it was really interesting with the fashion industry, with, you know, what type of shoes you're wearing, who you're sitting with, where you're sitting. I mean, it was like things that I just don't think about, you know, but it was a very educational thing. And I think that's also what allowed me when this work of mine, because I always used art as a way of asking questions, but it was the tarot that shifted something. It was something ancient happened, because then I did a series called The Universe's Organism, a series of paintings, and my books, The Codex Tour. They ended up with Flying Lotus on his album, Cosmogramma. And even the Rolling Stones used my work for a grimoire that I'd created for a movie called Shadow of the Vampire, directed by a friend of mine, Elias Marriage, and John Malkovich and Willem Dafoe were starring in it, but it became this vampire grimoire that ended up then on the Vampire Chronicles. Unbeknownst to them, it wasn't old, it was mine, so it turned out to be a very nice thing for me. But they used it on the originals, which is what it was called, as Esther's grimoire. And so all the, you know, and these things I would be doing while I was acting. Like, I'd be working on my Codex Tour, I'd be working on my tarot, I'd be working on my paintings, and all the time I'd be having the discussion groups, and then of course home life. And then we are you know, we have two daughters and a wonderful relationship. And I really feel that part of the 65-year-old in me now was that we live in an age driven by the desire for celebrity, but celebrity in and of itself can possibly create the conditions where you're freed to finally ask questions that are not bound to not having enough time or money or possibly, you know, to really saying, this offers me an environment. But that if one seeks it in and of itself, it's not simply hollow, it's empty. And leads a person to a type of despair. I saw that over and over again, because people were given what they thought they wanted, only to think, this cannot be it. And so what I've learned over the 65 years is it's that you can't enforce that others ask the questions, nor should you say to others, oh, you should ask the questions. I realized that part of my acting career taught me, Lee, you're too complicated in this office. You know, don't talk about these things. Keep it simple. Talk about the role. Talk about, don't bring up things, because it's confusing. You know, sort of know who to talk, you know, when in Rome, know who to talk to. And so I started to become much more private and almost cultivate two different lives. And the acting life allowed me to, you know, go through really different experiences as an actor that I absolutely loved, working with different people, different actors. But it was always as if it was acting as my protector, as my you know, so the quality that would whisper in my ear, Lee, you have no idea how fortunate you are as an artist to be left alone, to ask these questions and to not ask anybody's opinion, to not ask anybody's permission, and to say at the end of the day, you know what, this is my home, and you have no more right to critique it than you do my daughter, and if you do, you'd better be willing to, well, I don't want to go there. But, you know, in other words, that certain things you that aren't up for barter. And I rather feel like that's what, even the symbolical nature of what I've ended up doing unintentionally, but again, going back to being a cave painter and loving the earth and being a son of this land, you know, I started to realize that it's embodying what the ancients really do, which is saying, your stories are not just you. Your stories are your ancestors. And the honoring of your ancestors is not getting somewhere. It's looking down. It's trusting your roots and trusting where you live. And I love that my hieroglyph of the human soul is painted on linoleum. Nothing's more ordinary and overlooked than linoleum. Nobody cares about a linoleum floor. You know, but my alchemy right. here didn't change it into gold. It said, no, it's still linoleum. And maybe that's the human story. No, you're still linoleum. You think you're ordinary. But that's not where it ends. This becomes the ground for the depth of your imagination, your own art of your life, whatever that is, your own. And I don't say art as a painter because people think it's about being creative. And I say, no. It's about approach. It's about a willingness to realize that even in great difficulty, like a sailor on the ocean, you're being mentored by waves that are not personal. They're difficult, but they're going to, as they pass, and as you are not undone by them, you will realize that your capacity is much greater than you could have imagined, and that could not have been given to you. You had to discover this in a time of trauma. And this is one of the things I want to tell people now, is because times are so traumatic, is to right. take a breath, pull back, you know, really try and pull back like a tree to feel that sense of connection to the earth and breathing in a way that isn't in a way just being lost, but in a way of saying, let me gather back my senses, let me become coherent. Let me realize I am the instrument and that it is up to me to begin to, and my philosophy has been that they said, people say, oh, do you believe this? And I say, no, I don't believe anything, but I do have a policy. It couldn't hurt. Do you know, like a ritual? I don't believe in the ritual,
right.
but it's nice, couldn't hurt. Do you know, and my other philosophy, and this I think is very helpful for people, is in the meantime, you know, my art exists not because I was ever recognized for it. No one showed up and said, oh, my God, we need to put this at the Met. As a matter of fact, it caused consternation because it didn't fall into that agreement at all. You know, it really is something that is a complete honoring of the creative spirit, essentially saying, this is my home, this is enough for me. I'm not out to convince the world. As an actor, I had to do that. I had to get my next job. I can do that. I can play that. I can be that. You know, but you reach a point where you say, I'm a gardener now, so I'll offer you the bouquets that come from here, but you're not going to correct my growing style. and I tell artist friends, I say, you've got to tell people now. I mean, the creative people have to say, listen, I'm not interested in what you think of my art. I'm interested in what my art makes you think. I want to have a conversation with you. I don't want to critique. I do that for myself. And this world yeah. prides itself on shooting another person down. And to me, those bad manners are exactly the exponential relationship to what's going on a big scale now. Dishonor. Now, if I were a director of actors, yeah. I'd be talking to them about their responsibility to leave their baggage at the door. It's not about,
right.
you know, everyone has their baggage. If you make your life about your baggage, it's not life. And I rather think that that's what the questions now are upon us. It's like, well, what are you paying attention to? What do you love? I don't care if it's butterflies. My God, go to the Arboretum and go see the butterflies. And take a pad and see where it takes you. Don't make it something big. You know? Wanted to see what was over on
yeah.
that mountain peak? God, go over and take a hike. Go look at it. It doesn't have to be something big. And I kind of feel like that's why my art makes me now, in all of this difficulty, very optimistic, why the archetypes do. You know, it's like saying, you know what? It's like you and I talking today. I just feel enthusiasm will go a long way. You know, like we're all disappointed.
Yeah.
We're all down. And I rather think that the inner consciousness that God essentially is a disappointed artist, meaning that we do such a good job of blaming everything that we don't see the beauty. We don't actually stop. And when we do, and this is my advice about the creative spirit, it's not trying to get an audience. It's almost like saying, do it privately now. Because if you're seen on the quantum, you're seen. And if you're not seen, you won't be seen no matter how much noise you're making. The game has changed, you know, and physics is trying to get at it. And this art of mine, this multidimensionality, is really trying to say, as actually a painting of mine, The Phoenix Arise, which I painted over a four-year period, finished it in 1997. It's 5 foot by 7 foot. And I created it in card form for an invitation for my book, which was published in 2003, Tarot Revision. And I dropped the cards. And when I dropped them, this painting of mine mirrored itself with the cards. And it created a DNA, a holographic, fractal DNA coming from a painting, a spontaneous act of creation, meaning the first language, but also something that had come from devotion, which is what we come from, if we think about it. Only like can reveal like. And if we think about art not as painting, but as creation, this is why it has a power over us that formulas and math and structure don't, is because we are alive. We don't have a formula for the life principle. We have lots of mathematics that give us the conceit that we know things, but really we see them as a type of storage system rather than a type of activation system. And here, what this is doing is it's trying to say, no, you're encoded now, and you're allowing yourself to be activated in ways that you will be able to create coherence, meaning that if we understand that to truly tell something or someone that you love and to hold that or to forgive or to, in a way, to feel compassion, I truly feel is what the larger system is asking now, this deeper neurology, meaning who, if not you, can make a change. And I kind of felt that with, I start telling people who've come to my discussion groups now. For years, I strained my eyes looking elsewhere, thinking, oh, it must be them, only to realize, no, it's us. It's those who show up. Without, as Henry Miller says, it's those who say yes, even before the question is asked. You know, we start to honor each other. So I try, you know, when I talk about you doing this, I really want to do it as an act of honor, saying, yeah, this is where, in a way, it's not doing something else. It's honoring the things that do matter to us, you know, connectivity. And wonder, I think.
Well, one thing that I wanted to ask you about, because it wasn't acting, but it was a short film called Den of Celestial Birds, and they had you on as a painter and a title designer. How was that, doing something other than acting on a film?
Well, you know, that actually, again, is my friend Elias Marriage. He had done Shadow of the Vampire, and we'd been great philosophical friends and dear friends. And it came from a conversation. It was actually Turner Classic Movies gave he and I think four other big directors, because he had some difficulties with health, and so it ended up he had to take a sabbatical, but at that point he was very, very successful, and they came to him and they said, we'll give you a budget and we want you to make a short film. And it was complete carte blanche. It was no, you have to make this, you have to make that. And he called me, and we talked about Din of Celestial Birds, and then this is where I started to understand the nature of a lot of my work as visual philosophy, meaning that the symbolical nature and what Din looks at completely visually, it's a type of primordial film. He did another film called Begotten, and that one's almost impossible to watch because it's so primordial. Do you know, in other words, you almost look like you're a voyeur looking into some dark world of some other age. But what he's able to get at, and what was extraordinary, working with another, actually 30 years younger than me, but Dave Wexler, who's been important for me because he was also created Phoenix Rising, a fractal film, and did a lot of work with me many years ago. He did the computer work, and then the composer Ben, who did just amazing music. And what I was able, what I did was I laid out, I essentially created all of the words and the structures that are very, like when they come up, that was mine. And so different things. So a lot of what even my Phoenix Arise, my mandalas that come from this painting that creates the DNA, is encoded into the Din of Celestial Birds. But that was actually one of, I think, four or five films that went to Telluride. You have to be invited, and there were thousands. So it was quite a, well, he's quite a extraordinary director. And so it was it really, and creating films that, and I think maybe it mirrors like my art. We're sort of brothers in that. You know, you ain't seen nothing like that. Compliment, you know. And it's interesting because we also have this, for some reason, deep desire to tell origin stories, you know, sort of the myth of Genesis. You know, why are we here? And we've always loved those themes. And I think that's why my work is the way it is. You know, I really wanted to know why. You know, not just why am I here, but why are we human? Why do we, you know, why do we go through so much difficulty? And Din really gets at this. One of the great things is, you know, there's finally this birth of a human, you know, but at the end, it's this human that is primordial, almost like you know, proto-human. And you realize that after this struggle of what am I, it raises up out of the sort of primordial goo, and it's still, there's no answer. Do you know, in a sense, there's nothing. And I rather think that this is what, for me, became in here, was this realization of this despair in the human being of what is the point? You know, why? What, you know, if over and over again, you know, we fall, we die, you know, what is the point? And what intrigues me is that my work, his work, and Dave Wexler's work really are, it's almost like cosmologists, you know, trying to say there is a why. And on my part, it's to say, let me take you to the library. Let's go to the hieroglyph of the human soul. Let's go home together. Let's ask the final question. How do I tell a story like family that says, you know what, I might not like my brother, but my mom doesn't want us to kill each other. We have to wash our hands. We have dinner together. How do we do that?
Right.
You know, to me, that's been the human question. You know, really going back to Cain and Abel, I kind of feel that we always want to look at things like they're in the past, but the element of looking more of things in depth, which is what the floor gave me, because I spent 3.5 years in the beginning painting the floor. So I was always looking down. I was always in, essentially, this animal or this child state, because on all fours you're looking into depth, you're not looking away. You know, when you're standing up, you're looking at or for something. And I started to realize that we've been looking and going forward for so long that we don't know, we really don't trust that there's anything in our depth. And what I love about the work, what I love about the relationship even with Elias, he is the one that I'd created this book of magical spells for. You know, he's the one we did Din together. And it ended up on the cutting room floor because of time constraints. But Keith Richards saw the work and it ends up with the Rolling Stones. So there's this magical sense that, like good theater, when we watch it, we go, it's not one character I'm looking at, right? I'm looking at a story being told through all the characters. And this is what I'm trusting more and more, is for us to realize that we are strangely connected by a type of innate attraction to this conversation. And that on an invisible level, that what we're attracted to is attracted to us. And one of the things I laugh about when Elias said, "Can you you create a grimoire?" and I said, "You mean a book of magical spells?" And I started to laugh. And I, you know, I'd done the tarot, and I thought, "Sure," it was this laughter of I'll work once again in an arcane direction, where no one is really looking, and I found it to be so rich because. It was what I experienced at Juilliard. I didn't realize it until later on, but all the acting exercises, the sensing exercises, the breathing and physical exercises, well, a lot of them were Gurdjieff or Buddhist or Christian mystic. You know, it was all these different traditions, but no one said they were this tradition or that tradition. They were just tools. And I really liked that. And that's what I love about my tarot. It's a tool set. I say it's not a belief. It's a tool. It allows us to ask questions in a highly creative and imaginative way, and that when we ask questions this way, we begin to trust that it's not an answer, per se, as much as a growing sense of a deeper awareness, almost like the flower reveals its fragrance. And you know, just to throw in why I'm optimistic with the Phoenix Arise painting is that it shows us this in a physical form. I did a TEDx talk called Phoenix Arise, the Blossoming Creation, about the painting. And mm-hmm. It's 10 minutes long, but it actually is, it showed me in a geometrical form that the geometry, the math, was telling me that as a species, we are going from a contracted, you know, think of the bud of a flower, a closed fist, from a time of budding, which means with a closed fist, it's about enduring weather, about being strong, about not being open. And that as we are driven home, as we feel in a way powerless on one level, we start to let go of holding on to old conceits that I call it, you know, vestiges of the old Messiah tradition, which is, I'll change the world. It's like, no, it's like I can't hold on to the ocean. I must, in a sense, come back finally into my vessel, into my relationship with these things. And I feel that that's what we're trying to do, is gently pull one another back to the, almost whisper, that it's the storytellers, not war, that changes things. And that even in the greatest darkness, the capacity to use story to transmute, as I say, to take that fire, that anger, that hatred, and to turn it down, to calm it down, to let it be, and I learned this with actually the strength archetype in the tarot. You know, how, because it was actually the question was, okay, Lee, this is why I have to chuckle. It was, I'm going to draw a picture of where the fire of cosmic mind is transmuted into the light of knowing. And yet, when we think of that, isn't that, and this was the Nagas, the serpent coming up behind Buddha, you know, the sense of being protected or shielded by these ancient forces so that the transformation can take place. And that the symbolism is that we are prepared, but we are being conditioned to ask a much more intimate set of questions. And that's one of the things that I say my art when people come here is that it gives us permission to say that some questions, you know what, maybe the world just isn't interested in, but I'm fascinated in, you know, and maybe it's not meant to be seen by lots, but you know what, I'll share it with my wife, my friends. And some of this, I kind of feel, brings a humility back of really almost like we're a gardening club. Like, you know, I thought my roses would go international and, you know, just the gang likes them, you know, type of thing. And a lot of people feel that way. And I keep feeling like, well, you know, don't think of it in a accountant's way of looking at the world, like what's the bottom line, where are your demographics, who have you convinced, and where's your audience, and you don't have any value unless you have such and such, or you convince so and so. You know, and this is the return of also what I wasn't expecting, but the return of the divine feminine that really happens in the hieroglyph of the human soul, the return of the great mother, of Sophia, of Eve, even, of the story of Adam and Eve, which is my third book, Adam Reborn and Eve Restored, a romance in two parts. I didn't expect any of this, but I started to realize that if we think of our journey away into the time of the Father, into the time of separation, into the time of a sense of I'm empty, there's something missing in me, I'm not important because I'm not like them. And that sense of emptiness and longing in the human heart to have some sense of meaning and really despairing that maybe there isn't, you know, but you start to say, well, what if that's been generating not just me? What if that's like every human? We have not known what the point is. And so we've been on this long journey away, searching, trying, creating different systems, this and that. And that 9/11 became the moment where we fell off of the scaffolding of our grand conceits that doesn't matter what the Pope thinks or about God. You know, when you fall back into domestic space, it's like your wife says, hey, take out the garbage. Quit getting, you know, get over this grand cosmology that you think is going to get you out of responsibility. You got too much to do. And I think that that's the practical feminine we've been not looking at and why it comes here so deeply, because her living waters here at Olendar, at my home, in the hieroglyph of the human soul, are really this restorative story. Actually, Kuan Yin, the Chinese mother goddess, was the first entity to emerge as I began the hieroglyph of human soul. And she said that I am mater, mater, mother. I'm the weave of all creation. I am whole and holy, and I return to you now the story that you are holographic. There is no there in a hologram. What you are doing now is to create a space, a place. And when we think about sacred space, you say, well, what was it? Why was it made of stone? Why didn't it have moving parts? Why didn't we plug in a computer? The sacred space is saying, no, you are the computer. I need you to plug into me. And like a theater piece, I need you to trust your nature to open up and to have a story that is intimate. And I think that that's the feminine here. And that's why this is also the home of husband and wife, because lover and beloved are naked with each other. And my God, your wife knows if you're lying. You can convince the neighbor, but I see you naked. You know, it's like, no, and I realize that if we look on a level of consciousness, that side of our consciousness, right, saying, I see you naked. Your excuses don't work. You know, take out the garbage. Get over yourself. Stop thinking your miraculous way of thinking means anything. You know, and I kind of feel like that's, it seems like, oh, well, gosh, I'm not important. It's like, no, it's the ego, the quality that has been developed in both male and female, but it's the masculine side of the mind that always wants to push and cultivate identity by, do you see what I've done? Do you see this? Do you see that? In a type of proof. And in that proving, it's to prove really to oneself that one is of value, because there's this deep fear that there's no there. There's nothing inside. So I'll keep moving very quickly. I'll keep on to the next task. And the feminine here, and I even think the pandemic has to do with it, when we go crazy, she says, you've been living a life looking over my shoulder, trying to get out of responsibility when I tell you the taking of them is what ultimately frees you. Because if you think about the human ego, we spend more of our time trying to figure out how to take a shortcut, how to get out of something, what the ramifications would be if we don't do it. And what I love about the feminine is, you know, and I said after my wife's stroke, you know, it became, and that was in 2003, it was like, you know, jump, how high? And it changed me. You know, it created really a grail night. How may I be of service? And if I don't like the feeling, it's like, well, get over it. I felt this with my mom and dad. They both, you know, for a 7-year period, I was their caretaker. And you know, when you're dealing with slow death, and then you're dealing with age, and, you know, I mean, you really aren't happy. And I started to understand you're not supposed to be. It's not the pursuit of happiness. if you're lucky, you will feel joy because it will come from right action, from not having tried to get out of responsibility. And it just seemed everything in my life said, even when the fires, I said that when the Woolsey Malibu Park fire here came here, it's like everything in life says you will not get out of direct responsibility. And this is why I tell my friends that are so angry and writing stuff so angry, I say, take it down a notch. Don't send fire. The log of righteousness is justified on both ends, but it's burning everyone up. You know, I mean, we have to be, and that's why I think that a lot of this, as I say, is a type of etiquette of energy, a type of understanding that there are manners involved. And that's the feminine here. You know, I will share my mysteries with you, but you must love me. I will not share them with you because you're smarter than me or you think you're superior to me. I don't even want you in my bed. Do you know that? Who are you, you egomaniacal fool? And you think, yeah, if I ever was saying, what would seduce you? It'd be, I find you fascinating. I don't expect something from you. May I bring something to you? Do you know, we start to change our relationship rather than this thousands of years of a child-parent relationship with authority. I will be rewarded if I am obedient. I will be rewarded and patted on the head if I impress the right people. And it's now saying your first responsibility is to what you love, not to be obedient to what you think will give you the things you think are missing. The things you think are missing are not missing because of them. They're missing because you're not allowing yourself to ask different questions. And you'd say from a gardener's point of view, yeah, you don't have any petunias. You're not planting any. It's not his fault. Get some petunias.
Well, we only got like, 13 minutes, but I did want to go over at least one thing. Because I have Star Trek connections. That's one word to call it. And the great thing about the Star Trek universe, as any Star Trek fan knows, is that all you need to do is one episode and you are forever in the Star Trek family. And you've done two. You did an episode of Voyager and an episode of Deep Space Nine. So if you just want to talk about each one of those briefly.
Well, I played an Illyrian warlord on Voyager. I remember I wanted to dominate worlds. I always tell people that because on Babylon 5, I was a monster, too. I said, you know, if you ever run into me in outer space, I'm not a good guy when you meet me in space. And then the Star Trek, the other one was Voyager and...
Deep Space Nine.
Deep Space Nine. Yeah, then I played a symbiote. I played Dax, that was actually fun. I got to be the Hannibal Lecter living inside of this girl to help her solve a mystery. And I only had little leopard spots. Now, when I did Voyager, I was the Illyrian warlord, and I guess there must still paint it over, but there was a painting of me as this warlord, and I thought that's not bad, except for the four nostrils, I guess, are a little disconcerting from a human point of view, but I enjoyed them. The one I remember most though is the Deep Space Nine, because that was a process first of the auditions, because they were really looking for that role, and then secondly because it just allowed me to sort of have a lot of fun being very dark and very evil. As I said, that was one of my questions. Why when the evil guy comes out, do I go, ooh? Like, no, guy must have visited a lot of worlds in this old body. But I kind of think consciousness takes on all sorts of different roles. Actually, it was not too far away, but we go back. But it was a dream. I remember I was so infuriated with Dick Cheney at one point, and I was just and I had a dream, and he was on stage playing Dick Cheney, and he walked off stage, and he was an actor playing Dick Cheney, and I went, oh my god, I fell for the role. You did such a great, you made me so angry. And it was so funny, because it was like, yeah, don't you know, in a sense, don't shout at the TV. In a way, you're looking at something that although seems very real, is much more put on to a certain degree, so that we don't blame the characters and think, oh, they are evil, as much as we realize the archetype, and we see the underpinnings that say it's not the reactive anger, the fire against, but if this appears, then what can I do? And what was very funny was that George Bush at the same time was working on SOFA, the Status of Forces Agreement, and I was painting my sofa. and I couldn't help but have this, oh, Brother George, hey, sofa and sofa. And it was my Status of Forces Agreement because essentially my sofa opens up and tells the story of the birth into creation. And I thought, how funny that there's this parallel conversation, which coming back to Star Trek, one wonders about this relationship to fantasy and science fiction and the telling of these stories, but telling them in a way that they do have, as you know, Star Trek fans know, there's something that is quite, yeah, that kind of makes sense. You know, in other words, it's the type of thing, and this is why I like theater. Oftentimes I think that you can tell a greater truth not by facts, which you insist upon people agree about, but actually a story that lets people take the journey. That's why I loved, especially as a little kid, I loved the original Star Trek, you know, with William Shatner.
Right, like, yeah.
Roddenberry was, I mean, he salted the minds of all of us. You know, I mean, really, to like Twilight Zone, to really consider things much more deeply than we were being taught, so to speak. And any questions, though, about those shows? I mean, because that's you know, the... you know, because all I know is that I was really glad that when I got the leopard spots, it was a lot less than taking off the prosthetics and the wig and the pins and the hair and the rubber cement. You know, so
you pretty much went over it, and I mean, you said you had fun, and so that's good when you can have a fun experience. But we are down to like 7 minutes. I mean, unless you have something else to say about Star Trek, that would be fine.
No, I'm just trying to think if there are any unanswered questions. I think it's great, the continuation of it, because I really do. I think it strikes a chord that allows people to have conversations and think about things. You know, and that's why a lot of times I tell people when I take them on the tour of the Hieroglyph of the Human Soul, and they look at me and I say, listen, if you can follow Star Trek, you can follow this.
Right.
This ain't more difficult. Different names, but it's a mythic structure telling you a story that wants to include you. You know, you really are the final frontier, if you want to know the truth.
Right. Exactly. I agree.
Yeah.
Well, we've got like 7 minutes left, and I did want you to, I mean, I know about it, but just to let the any listeners we may have, to let them know about your website, because I'm looking at it right now, actually, and it's got the hieroglyph right there on the homepage, and I'll let you tell the people about that.
I feel that one of the great things with Google now and the other search engines is you can put Lee McCloskey art or Hieroglyph the Human Soul or Tarot or Grimoire or Codex Tor or Cosmogramma or Flying Lotus or Rolling Stones, and it all comes up. So, but if I was going to say just in simple terms, Lee McCloskey, which is L-E-I-G-H, McCloskey, which is M-C-C-L-O-S, KEY.com. That has an introduction to my work. There's also the frontis image is a beautiful image Dana Tynan, a wonderful friend and photographer, took of me, where it shows the studio. It shows this mysterious environment, but as I like to say, this act of devotion. And so on my website, it has connections to Amazon if you want to buy my tarot revision book. My Codex Tor books are in the process. They're out of print, but we're trying to get electronic versions also of my tarot revision book, because it's a great, we just finished a Zoom gathering on Fridays and went over the last 22 weeks. We went through the book together. It's a great book to read together. I really suggest if you go to leemcloskey.com, go to Tarot. I have an example chapter posted of the justice archetype, and you can read, see if you relate to it, look at the images, they're all there. And if they speak to you, you know, you can order the cards, you can order the book, and I really feel at this time in history, it's a very good thing to even think about having a discussion group, a reading group, and saying, you know what, I don't really know too much about this, you don't know too much about this, but maybe together with a book we can enter into these waters and with our curiosity begin to trust our journey with this will be unique, but let's use it as a tool. And so that's what I would suggest. Another book of mine, Adam Reborn and Eve Restored, is a beautiful revision of Genesis. I was not expecting to tell or write, but if you Google Lee McCloskey Eve, you'll see her. And when I painted her, she began telling me this remarkable story about Adam Reborn and Eve Restored. And I really feel that, as I said, if I were rich, I'd put it next to every Gideon Bible just as a, and this as well. Not to correct anything that's out there, but just to say maybe let's add this as well. And the other, I think my Wikipedia page finally is a very good resource and has a lot of connections to what's important. I did a series called of short talks called Food for Thought. If you just Google my name, Food for Thought. Lee McCloskey, Food for Thought. I wanted to address, you know, questions like, well, what do you do with the despair? What do you do with anger? How do you deal with, you know, disappointment, rage? What are the symbolical stories behind the outer stories? And so I talk, I have little short videos, some with the tarot, some that are just really almost like a fireside chat, just trying to say, you know, let's take a moment and talk together, because I didn't want to talk about a lot of things, but one question, and then but to look at it deeply. Also on YouTube, I have a lot of talks, everything from the Divine Feminine to the story of the mandala, to the tarot, to the story of the Watchers and the Watcher language, and so a lot of it that I would very much suggest just sort of seeing if it tweaks your curiosity. The talk I gave on the Grail, if you're interested in the Grail, is part of the story you have not heard, and part of the story that I think will, a bit like my tarot work, because I feel like the happy archaeologist. It'll just take you into a deeper place, and because it's deeper, it will actually feel more intimate. It won't feel like you have to learn something, but much more like you're remembering something. And then I would say with that probably is the best way to enter. And I just found really Googling my name and art, and then things come up and they pop up. But everything I've put out there has been to give an opportunity to people to hear and listen to parts of the story, whether it's stories about alchemy, like, well, what is alchemy? What's the point? You know, the tarot, why does it matter? What do these things, you know? I've tried to address that in a way that allows it not to be, oh, you have to believe these things and follow anything, because I'm interested in, as I say, better theater. So I'm trying to create tools for us to trust our curiosity and our imagination and to begin at this point in time to think of ourselves as gardeners, you know, to say I'll cultivate not something I'll prove to the world something with, but something that matters to me. So as you look through the art and my writing, I'm on Facebook as well. You can follow me on Facebook. I always post. I just posted things on the fires on the archetypes, and it's very helpful, I think. And then I also have Olandar, Olandar, Foundation for Emerging Renaissance. That's Olandar Foundation for Emerging Renaissance. The acronym is OFFER. It's an offer, but you can go on Facebook and look there, join there, follow there. And what's interesting even about the hieroglyph of the human soul, the acronym, which I was not expecting 10 years into that, I said, well, what is it? And I realized it's THOTHS, which is thoughts, or Thoth Hermes, which is the Hermetic tradition. So there's all these marvelous things about returning to the library. So see where it takes you. Just follow and see how it plays. You know, so and if you want to contact me, just contact me through the website. I'd love to hear what you have to say and respond.
And you timed that perfectly because we're into our last 10 seconds. So, and they have a tendency sometimes to cut you off. So, I just want to say thank you for being on the show. You were a joy to have, and I really appreciated you being on and all the things you had to say. And maybe sometime in the future you might want to be on again. Thank you very much.
I look forward to it, Mac. You have a great evening. Thanks so much, and thanks, everybody else. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you, too. Good night.